I am Valentin Fuster, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, or JACC, summarizing the issue of November the 3rd of 2020. We have 5 original articles on diverse topics in a superb seminar on venous thromboembolism with 4 different articles. The 5 original papers address the following issues: characterization of myocardial injury in patients with COVID-19, a registry of arterial and venous thromboembolic complications in patients with COVID-19, effects of canagliflozin on amino-terminal pro-B-type natriuretic peptide and implications for cardiovascular risk reduction. A very interesting article, circulating omega-3 fatty acids and incident adverse events in patients with acute myocardial infarction. And finally, cardiovascular care for pregnant women with cardiovascular disease. The seminar on venous thromboembolism presents 4 topics: venous thromboembolism associated with pregnancy, antithrombotic management of venous thromboembolism, advanced management of intermediate and high-risk pulmonary embolism, and chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, a real up-to-date of 4 such important topics. Let's begin with the first original paper. It is entitled Characterization of Myocardial Injury in Patients with COVID-19. And this was the question. Based in 305 patients from an international study involving Mount Sinai in New York and Milan in Italy, what was the relationship between myocardial injury and echocardiographic patterns? And most importantly, what about their relationship with mortality? These 305 patients, COVID positive, that were hospitalized, the mean age was 63 years, and 67% were male. The following observations were made. Myocardial injury was observed in 62% of these patients. Patients who had more electrocardiographic abnormalities, higher inflammatory biomarkers, and increased prevalence of measured echocardiographic abnormalities as compared with those patients who did not have myocardial injury. Second, the increased prevalence of measured echocardiographic abnormalities included, almost in similar proportions, left ventricular wall motion abnormalities, global left ventricular dysfunction, left ventricular diastolic dysfunction, right ventricular dysfunction, and pericardial effusions. And third, most importantly, the rates of in-hospital mortality were 5% in those patients without myocardial injury, 18% in those patients who had myocardial injury without echocardiographic abnormalities, and in 31% in those who had both myocardial injury and echocardiographic abnormalities. So in conclusion, among patients with COVID-19 who underwent transthoracic echocardiography, cardiac structural abnormalities were present in nearly 2/3 of patients with myocardial injury. Myocardial injury was associated with increasing hospital mortality, particularly if echocardiographic abnormalities were present. Just for the record, myocardial injury was defined as any elevation in cardiac troponin at the time of clinical presentation or during the hospitalization. I have 2 comments. The fact that myocardial injury was observed in 62% of the patients means that the study was somewhat selective. Since, as we published recently, out of 3,000 patients hospitalized in the Mount Sinai hospitals that were COVID positive, overall, the incidence of injury, of myocardial injury, was 36%. A figure very close to the figure in other institutions. On the other hand, and this is important, myocardial injury is very often associated with echocardiographic abnormalities, and both together have a significant impact in mortality. I just like to add that based in these studies and in other present studies in the literature, the cause of myocardial injury most likely first relates to the cytokines released by the inflammatory process in COVID-19. Second, the microvasculature with thrombosis may also be involved in the myocardial dysfunction. And third, probably very infrequently, the myocarditis or myocardial dysfunction seen at echocardiography may relate to the direct impact of the virus. I repeat, and according to the literature, this mechanism is probably very infrequent. The second original paper is entitled Registry of Arterial and Venous Thromboembolic Complications in Patients with COVID-19. This is a retrospective study analyzing over 1,000 patients with COVID-19 diagnosed through the Mass General Brigham Integrated Health Network. And this was the question. Based in 170 patients that were seen in intensive care, 229 that were hospitalized in the non-invasive care, and 715 that were outpatients. The question was, how frequently measured arterial or venous thromboembolism was observed? How frequently measured cardiovascular adverse events were seen? And how frequently patients had symptomatic venous thromboembolism? Despite of 85% of the patients being on anticoagulation, the results appear to be impressive. Measured arterial or venous thromboembolism in 35% of the patients. Measured cardiovascular adverse events in 46% of the patients, and symptomatic venous thromboembolism in 27% of the patients. Frankly, I couldn't understand this data, and particularly, as I said, when 85% of the patients were on anticoagulants. Looking at the paper in detail, however, two important points of caution evolve. The first is that in the three objectives, many of the patients belong to each of the objectives. We are talking about the three outcomes. But second, and most importantly, while the overall venous thromboembolic rate among ICU patients was high, 27%, the vast majority of these events were attributable to central venous lines, 76%. 2.4% only developed a proximal leg deep venous thrombosis, and only 1.8% of the patients experienced a pulmonary embolism. One patient suffered a stroke, and 13 patients with myocardial infarction or well non-ST segment elevation. So with this information, now I begin to understand that anticoagulants, rather than being non-effective, they might have been effective. An interesting paper for debate. The third original paper is entitled Effects of Canagliflozin on Aminoterminal Pro-B type Natriuretic Peptide, Implications for Cardiovascular Risk Reduction. One of the key questions in patients with heart failure, and according to the literature, is whether biomarkers, for example, biomarkers of stress myocardium, such as NT-proBNP, play a role in predicting outcomes, and most importantly, whether they serve as monitors of therapeutic effectiveness. Such question was addressed today in this article published in JACC, which is based in over 4,000 participants in the Canvas trial. Participants that were individuals with type 2 diabetes and a high risk for cardiovascular events. The participants were randomized to canagliflozin or placebo, and the treatment was associated with reduced risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, including hospitalization for heart failure. In this study of over 4,000 participants, NT-proBNP was measured at baseline, at 1 year, and at 6 years. 39% of the participants had a high NT-proBNP of equal or more than 125 picograms per mil. Observation number one, NT-proBNP was higher in those with investigator-reported heart failure, 13% of the participants, as compared with those without heart failure, 187 picograms per mil versus 81 picograms per mil. However, there was substantial overlap between both groups. Second, in adjusted models, baseline NT-proBNP equal or more than 125 picograms per mil was prognostic for incidence heart failure, cardiovascular death, and all-cause death at follow-up. However, and this is the third observation, by 1 year, NT-proBNP increased with placebo, while canagliflozin reduced NT-proBNP by only 11%. And furthermore, this is observation number four. Mediation analysis suggested that only 10% of the effects of canagliflozin on heart failure were reflected in NT-proBNP lowering. So the overall results were somewhat disappointed. And these were the conclusions. A substantial percentage of patients in the CANVAS trial had elevated NT-proBNP values. Canagliflozin reduced NT-proBNP concentrations versus placebo. However, reduction in NT-proBNP explained only a small proportion of the benefit of canagliflozin on heart failure events. In other words, it may be that validated biomarkers such as NT-proBNP will never be sufficient to fully predict registration of a new effective therapy for heart failure independent of clinical outcomes assessment. The fourth original paper is entitled Circulating Omega-3 Fatty Acids and Incident Adverse Events in Patients with Acute Myocardial Infarction. First of all, as you know, a lot has been written about omega-3 fatty acids. The most quoted are EPA, ALA, and DHA. For decades, omega-3 fatty acids have been controversial in terms of whether or not they could protect cardiovascular health. As pointed out in the paper presented today in JACC, perhaps the doses used were too low. Some kind of resuscitation of the possible role of omega-3 fatty acids came recently with the reduced EAT trial and with the evaporate trial. In both, a synthetic type of EPA, icosapent, clearly exerted a beneficial effect in terms of cardiovascular endpoints, this in the reduced study, and on the incidence of plaque volume and composition addressed by non-invasive computed tomography in patients with elevated levels of triglycerides, and this as part of the evaporate study. The study today in JACC is not a study of pills, it's a study of diet. The study we are summarizing is based on the premise that serum EPA and serum ALA levels represent respectively fish and vegetable intake And so to correlate such levels then to the incidence of major adverse cardiovascular events or MACE, all-cause mortality, and readmission for cardiovascular causes at 3 years of follow-up. The study was based in near 1,000 consecutive patients with a STEMI, and of these patients with an average age of 61 years and 209 women, the number of events as outcomes that we mentioned were evaluated, with the following two observations being made. And here's observation number one. Serum EPA at the time of STEMI was inversely associated with both incident MACE and cardiovascular readmission, with respective hazard ratios of 0.76 and 0.74. This comparing elevated serum EPA levels with normal levels. And here's observation number two. Serum ALA was also inversely related to all-cause mortality, with a hazard ratio of 0.65. So in conclusion, elevated serum EPA and ALA levels at the time of STEMI were associated with a lower risk of clinical adverse events. Consumption of foods rich in these fatty acids may improve the prognosis of STEMI. This is an excellent prospective study, bringing up to discussion 2 points. The first is that perhaps is the amount of omega-3 fatty acids that have a beneficial effect in terms of cardiovascular health, as it is shown in the study published today in JACC and suggested by the recent REDUCE-IT study and the EVAPORATE study. But there is a second point. How these omega-3 fatty acids are protective? And there is some evidence that ingestion by food of such omega-3 fatty acids may lead to their deposition in the membrane of the cells, including the cardiomyocytes, there specifically making myocardial oxygen consumption more efficient, and also as protectors against a variety of heart stressors. In other words, we are getting back in the omega-3 fatty acid fish business, and also vegetables. It makes sense. The fifth original paper is entitled Cardiovascular Care for Pregnant Women with Cardiovascular Disease. In this study, the investigators identified patients evaluated by a cardio-obstetric team from January of 2010 through December of 2019. This evaluation by a specific cardio-obstetrics team was done at the Columbia University Irving Medical Center in New York. During the study period, 306 pregnant women with a median age of 29 years, 52% Hispanic or Latino, with cardiovascular disease were seen. Most women, or 74%, were insured through Medicaid. The study was designed to answer one question. How these patients do under such a strict cardio-obstetrics team effort? Actually, I can give the answer. They do very well. Although the problem is that there was no control group. These were the specific observations made. First, the most common forms of cardiovascular disease included arrhythmia in 29% of the patients, congenital heart disease in 24%, and cardiomyopathy in 24%. In terms of the degree of cardiac disease, the investigators used the so-called cardiac disease in pregnancy 2 score, or CARPREC 2. So just for the record, the median CARPREC 2 score was 3. Although in 42% of the patients was rather high, with a score equal or more than 4. So a population of pregnant women with moderate to significant cardiac disease. Observation number 2. Gestational diabetes occurred in 11% of the patients, gestational hypertension in 9%, and preeclampsia in 12%. Intensive care unit admission was only required in 8% of the patients during delivery. And here's observation number 3. Median gestational age for delivery was 38 weeks. Live birth occurred in 98% of the pregnancies. There was only one maternal death with Eisenmenger syndrome. Furthermore, following delivery, 30-day readmission rate was only 2%, and readmission from 30 to 90 days postpartum was only 4%. All being evaluated with a median follow-up of 2.6 years. So in conclusion, in a population of primarily Medicaid-insured pregnant women managed by a cardio-obstetric team, maternal outcomes were encouraging and readmission rates following delivery were low. Prospective studies are needed to evaluate the impact of cardio-obstetric models of care on maternal outcomes. Again, an excellent study with excellent results, particularly taking into account that 74% of these women were insured through Medicaid, with the only problem that this excellent data should be validated in a prospective randomized study. The question is whether such a study is feasible. So this is the end of the summary of the 5 original papers published today in JACC in the issue of November the 3rd. I would encourage you to have a look at the seminar on venous thromboembolism, seminar that I tried to summarize with the 4 topics being addressed within a period of about 1 hour. So let's continue to move on. Thank you. Until next week.